This week, our ongoing reading of Power and Powerlessness, published in 2006 by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, deals with how the capitalist system has changed the nature of the family to suit its purposes, and how, in spite of the lip service given to family values, families today are buckling under the pressure generated by the drive for profit. In last week's chapter, Susan explained in detail capitalism's prime directive, compete or die. The competition for capital respects no limits, subordinating everyone and everything to the quest for profit. Economic competition has pushed productivity so high that everyone could have a decent standard of living. Yet the situation of working people is far worse than a generation ago. It now takes two wage earners to live less well than a family with only one wage earner could live a generation ago. As the capitalist class controls the production, the more workers produce, the more capitalists take, and the less workers get in relation to what they produce. She explained that the role of the military in capitalist competition is to secure resources and markets for the capitalists of that nation. This is what is meant when politicians discuss, for example, U.S. interests. The only force that exists in opposition to this most deadly form of competition is the desire of ordinary people of all nations to live in peace. Chapter 7, Burden the Family. Our culture places tremendous value on self-sufficiency and self-reliance. Just as individuals are esteemed for taking care of themselves rather than relying on others, effective families are glorified as being self-contained, self-regulating, autonomous entities. Stephen Gold. In 2001, Andrea Yates methodically drowned her 5 children, one by one, in the bathtub of their Texas home. How could a mother do such a thing? Yates was diagnosed with postpartum psychosis when she tried to kill herself after her 4th child was born. After giving birth to her 5th child, she was prescribed antipsychotic medications. 3 months later, her father died and her mental state deteriorated. A few months after that, she drowned all of her children. Expecting a grieving, psychotic woman to take care of 5 young children under the age of 7 is a tragedy waiting to happen. Those children might be alive today if their family had been given more support. However, families are not supposed to need support, especially not fundamentalist Christian families like the Yates. Andrea was expected to have as many children as she could and school them at home, which was a 350-square-foot converted bus. She was not to have any friends, interests, or activities outside of her family, and she was to accept her husband's authority in all matters. According to religious commentator Anne Eggebrotten, the conditions of her life were unbearable, but to challenge them would have been to oppose God's will. She did not see the drownings as a sin in the eyes of God. In fact, she felt she had already committed the greater sins, being a bad mother and producing children who were ruined and would go to hell if allowed to reach adulthood. She had twice tried to kill herself for this sin and failed. Close quote. The prison psychiatrist described Yates as severely mentally ill. Nevertheless, she was charged with murder. At trial, the prosecuting attorney warned jurors that a guilty verdict was necessary to deter other mothers from murdering their children. Yates was convicted and sentenced to 40 years in prison without parole. During the trial, no one condemned the burdens that had broken this family. The Big Squeeze. Most families suffer from severe stress. In 2001, 84% of women and 82% of men reported that their lives were moderately or extremely stressful. People between 25 to 44 years of age, the child-raising years, reported the highest stress levels. A 2005 study found that parents of both sexes were more likely to report depression than non-parents. Why is this happening? The drive to increase productivity and profits sucks the life out of the family. Men's wages have fallen, and the cost of living has climbed, forcing women out to work to keep their families afloat. In 2003, 78% of women with school-aged children worked outside the home, including 59% of women with children under the age of 5. Women's wages are essential for family survival. In 2003, 62% of working women brought home more than half of their entire family's income. More hours on the job mean fewer hours at home. Between the early 1970s and the later 1980s, one-third of the time that people had off the job disappeared. After grocery shopping, cooking, cleaning, and laundry, most people don't have time for themselves, let alone for their children. Joan, a 28-year-old mother of two, describes her situation, quote, "My husband and I work 4 jobs between us. We can't afford childcare, so we work staggered shifts 7 days a week. When he's at work, I'm at home, and vice versa. I rarely see him. We leave notes for each other, and we never get to be a family together. But it's the only way we can keep a roof over our heads and pay the bills." Close quote. Financial necessity forces many parents to work as much overtime as they can get. Bill drives transport trucks and may not see his family for days at a time. Although he misses them terribly, he reasons, "I can spend time with my kids, or I can feed them." Despite working harder than ever, most families are financially insecure. When women go out to work, families have added expenses like childcare. A second car may be needed where public transportation is inadequate. In 2004, more than 3 out of 10 Americans named transportation as their biggest monthly expense after rent or mortgage payments. Medical bills have become a nightmare for families. According to a 2004 survey by the Kaiser Family Foundation, nearly 1/4 of Americans had problems paying their medical bills. More than 60% of these people had medical insurance. More than 1 in 5 Americans has an overdue medical bill. 15% were contacted by a collection agency because of medical bills, and 8% borrowed money or took out another mortgage to pay for medical care. Nearly 3 in 10 adults could not afford to pay for medical care at some time over the previous year. This figure is almost double what it was in 1976. By 2001, total household debt was 10% greater than total household disposable income. In Life in Debt, Why American Families Are Borrowing to the Hilt, Alex Baker writes, quote, "Debt burdens are at record levels because families have been stretched to the limit in recent years. With more income going to houses and other rising expenses related to medical care, education, vehicles, child care, and so forth, families are relying on credit as a way to meet everyday needs. Remarkably, a family with 2 earners today actually has less discretionary income after fixed costs like medical insurance and mortgage payments are accounted for than did a family with only 1 breadwinner in the 1970s. Close quote. According to Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tyagi, authors of The 2-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke, quote, "This year, more people will end up bankrupt than will suffer a heart attack. More adults will file for bankruptcy than will be diagnosed with cancer. More people will file for bankruptcy than will graduate from college. And in an era where traditionalists decry the demise of the institution of marriage, Americans will file more petitions for bankruptcy than for divorce." Close quote. The decline in real wages combined with the rising cost of necessities has caused bankruptcy rates to escalate. 90% of bankruptcies result from excessive medical bills, job loss, and divorce. Compared with their parents' generation, today's families are 5 times more likely to go bankrupt and 3 times more likely to lose their homes. Families with children are more than twice as likely to file for bankruptcy and 75% more likely to lose their homes than families without children. The state does not help families that are drowning in debt. On the contrary, a 2005 federal law makes it harder for ordinary people to declare bankruptcy and start over. At the same time, a millionaire's loophole lets the rich shield their assets from creditors and lets corporations declare bankruptcy to avoid paying pensions and medical benefits. Women's oppression. Unlike machines that can be worked continuously, human beings need time to rest and recover their energy. And while machines enter the world fully formed, human beings take years to mature. As a result, every society must solve the problem of how to maintain those who labor, how to respond to sick, injured, and old workers, and how to raise the next generation of workers. Egalitarian societies shared these tasks. Everyone helped to care for the young and supported the disabled and elderly. This changed with class society. To maximize profits, the ruling class shuns responsibility for the maintenance and reproduction of the working class. Consequently, the bulk of this burden falls upon the individual family, primarily upon the women in the family, who cook, clean, do laundry, care for sick and elderly relatives, and raise young children. The capitalist state provides some social services, but never enough to lift the burden of reproduction from the family. In 1995, it was calculated that if employers and governments had to pay for all the socially necessary work done in the family, it would cost them $11 trillion worldwide and $1.4 trillion in the U.S. alone. Unpaid domestic labor represents a massive financial gift to the system and is the root source of women's oppression. As long as women must do socially necessary labor in the home, they cannot participate in work and society as equals with men. Employers take advantage of women's domestic responsibilities to pay them lower wages. Lower wages make women workers more desirable. However, to engage all women in the workforce, employers would have to pay or provide 24-hour childcare, convenient family eateries, and drop-off laundries. The cost of these services would negate the profit to be made by employing women. Capitalism has a conflict. It wants women in the home providing free social services, and it also wants them in the workforce making profits. This conflict is reproduced within each woman's life. A lack of social services compels women to work at home, and financial necessity compels them to also work outside the home. To manage this double burden, 40% of employed women work evenings, nights, or weekends on a regular basis. To provide continuous care for their children, 1 in 3 employed women works a different shift from her mate. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. The Reproductive Nuclear Family. The modern family was formed during the Industrial Revolution. Within feudal societies, extended families lived and farmed together. The intensity of work changed with the seasons, and the length of the workday was determined by the amount of daylight. Capitalism shattered these families, sucking men, women, and children into the factory system and working them around the clock. Each family member might work in a different location, and all labored such long hours they seldom saw each other. The sick, injured, and elderly were left to fend for themselves. Pregnant women worked until they went into labor, and they returned to work immediately after giving birth. The infant death rate skyrocketed. Surviving children were put to work as young as 2 years of age. Parents could neither protect nor care for their children, and children, as one investigator at the time remarked, neither recognized duties to their parents nor felt any affection for them. In 19th century England, the lifespan of the average factory worker fell to 18 years. Under such terrible conditions, the working population could not reproduce itself. Something had to be done. However, the capitalist class refused to pay for social supports for the working class. Pressed by workers' demands, government reformers enacted laws that excluded women and children from the most dangerous jobs and prohibited the younger children from working. These and other laws and practices increased women's financial dependence on men, made men responsible for supporting women and children, held parents responsible for raising children, restricted divorce, and severely punished male homosexuality. The nuclear family was born, and it was very different from what had come before. Feudal families were units of production and reproduction. Many generations worked and lived together, so their ties to the land made these families relatively stable. By removing production from the family and locating it in the workplace, capitalism created a family system with only one function, reproduction. This kind of family is more vulnerable to disintegration. Today, half of all marriages end in divorce, and this figure would be higher if divorce did not bring so much financial hardship. World War II showed how easily the reproductive family could break down. In America, the state established a system of comprehensive child care so that women could take industrial jobs. During this time, same-sex relationships flourished. After the war, during the 1950s, a repressive campaign was launched to rebuild the nuclear family. The better-paying jobs were closed to women, and funding for child care was cut off, forcing women back into the home. Psychiatry labeled homosexuality a mental illness to be, quote, treated with castration, lobotomy, electroshock, and forced confinement in psychiatric institutions. Women who suffered emotional problems from constricted lives were prescribed psychiatric drugs called mother's little helpers. The biological need to belong causes people to gravitate towards each other. How they live together is socially determined. To maintain the reproductive family, society restricts the ways in which people can live. Housing is designed for nuclear families composed of two parents and their children. Most cities regulate how many non-related people can live in one dwelling. Same-sex couples and people designated as non-related are denied rights granted to family members, including employment benefits, Social Security, and a say in medical and legal matters that affect their loved ones. The reproductive family system is maintained by force of law, medicine, religion, and custom. The oppression of women is key. If women were free to work as they pleased, to choose their partners as they felt, and to have or not have children as they wished, the reproductive family system would be replaced by different family forms that actually met people's needs. To sustain the nuclear family system, women must be compelled to work in the home by denying them other options. Restrictions on contraception and abortion rob women of control over their reproductive functions. Lack of child care and other social supports force women to provide cooking, cleaning, and child care services in the home. Lower wages, the absence of paid maternity leave, and little or no job security after pregnancy kept most women in a state of financial dependence on higher-waged men. Forcing men to support women and children provides the added bonus of controlling male workers. Spouses who want out of marriages and parents who want relief from child care duties can be prosecuted and held financially responsible for dependents. Youngsters who run away from home are forcibly returned to their families, placed in alternate families, or confined in detention centers. The American Psychiatric Association persists in designating variations in sexual behavior as mental disorders, and homosexuals continue to be victims of discrimination, violence, and murder. The systematic underfunding of social services forces a lifelong dependence on the family. Those who are sick, injured, unemployed, broke, or in trouble are expected to rely on their families. Existing social supports are either too expensive, private care, or so inadequate, institutional care, that only the most desperate people use them. To make the absence of alternatives more palatable, the reproductive family is praised as the best way the only way to live. Family values. The phrase family values evokes warm images of love, comfort, and mutual aid, what everyone desires. Ironically, this slogan is used to deprive families of social support. While the state supports the capitalist class in innumerable ways, it provides next to nothing for families. The richest nation in the world does not provide paid leave for workers to care for needy relatives. Currently, 12% of women and 8% of men care for a sick or aging relative. 29% of these caregivers provide more than 40 hours assistance per week. There is no paid maternity leave and no national system of child care in the United States. Individual parents are solely responsible for nurturing, socializing, and educating children before they enter the school system. In this privatized system of reproduction, good parents are expected to find the resources they need, and those who cannot are condemned as bad parents lacking family values. Psychologist Stephen Gold explains, quote, "Hidden behind the aura of dominion implied by the term family values is the expectation and demand that families be self-sufficient. Not only should they be liberated from the constraints of outside forces, they should be capable of functioning without depending on external supports and should be independent of outside influences," close quote. Advocates of, quote, family values oppose social support for families. They insist that a woman's place is in the home, even though most women must work outside the home and need child care to do so. Publicly provided child care has been shown to be as good or better for children than home parenting. Nevertheless, politicians use pro-family arguments to oppose funding child care programs. The lies that all you need is love and love conquers all serve to deprive working people of social resources. Media campaigns push the importance of good parenting at the same time that funding for children's programs like Head Start is reduced or eliminated. In 2000, the Invest in Kids Foundation organized a mass campaign to love your child to launch your child. Parents were urged to spend quality time with their kids and involve them in music and art. This joint government-corporate crusade was launched at the same time that family, recreation, and school support programs were being scrapped to pay for corporate tax cuts. Parents want to provide their children with the best start in life, and they need social support to do so. State-funded child care, unemployment insurance, social assistance, Social Security, Medicare, and paid leave are a form of social wage that benefits the entire workforce. Studies show that workers are more productive, absent less often, and stay longer with companies that provide these benefits. For these reasons, some employers do provide family support for difficult-to-replace employees. In general, however, it is most cost-effective not to provide social benefits and to condemn families that cannot manage this on their own. Children pay the price. All mammals have an inborn attachment system that connects newborns to adults who can nurture and protect them. The human attachment system is especially important for the development of the human brain. However, the capitalist family system is designed to replace the labor force, not to promote healthy human development. Let me explain. At birth, human infants cannot regulate their feelings. When newborns are hungry, they are completely, totally, and desperately hungry, with no memory of not being hungry and no sense that hunger will ever end. Now is all there is, and now is filled with hunger. When an adult responds to the infant's hunger cry with food and soothing touch and voice, the infant's hunger is replaced with satisfaction and comfort. Thousands of such interactions teach the child that food follows hunger, and so he learns to tolerate feeling hungry. The same process applies to other emotions. Infants need adults to tune in to their needs, feeding them when they are hungry, soothing them when they are distressed, providing them with stimulation when needed, and allowing them to pull away when overstimulated. Embraced in a synchronized emotional dance with a caregiver, children learn how to manage a wide variety of feelings and situations, developing a balanced nervous system that is neither too aroused nor too withdrawn. Adults don't need to be perfect to provide this secure base for children. They only need to be available and responsive most of the time. The reproductive family is not structured to provide that time. It takes a village to raise a healthy child. However, most people live in overburdened, isolated family units. In a village, children can form bonds with many adults, so that there is always someone available in times of need. The nuclear family has at best two accessible adults and often only one. When parents are busy, stressed, sick, or needy, many children have no one else to turn to. Unlike adults, children cannot put events into context. When they are pressed into the service of overwhelmed parents, take care of your mother, father, children mistakenly conclude that their own needs are unimportant and that they do not deserve to have their needs met. Children are psychologically more vulnerable than adults because immature nervous systems cannot handle intense emotions. Children in stressed families need more time and attention, more calming and soothing. However, these are the times when parents have the least to give. Not surprisingly, sickness and stress in parents is strongly correlated with emotional problems in children. In such situations, parents and children can become trapped in a cycle of deprivation, where adult stress triggers child distress, and child distress elevates adult stress. Whether professionals treat the overwhelmed parent or the distressed child, the social problem of overwhelmed families is rarely acknowledged. When most people hear the phrase childhood trauma, they think of child abuse. In fact, most childhood trauma is not abuse. Children are most frequently traumatized by separations, when a parent is injured, imprisoned, deported, or dies, and when family members are dislocated by war and other disasters. Youngsters who seem calm in such crises are actually dissociating, which increases the risk of developing post-traumatic stress disorders later on. Children who experience too much stress and receive too little nurturing have more difficulty managing strong emotions like fear, grief, and anger. To shift out of intolerable emotional states, these children may bang their heads, engage in prolonged rocking, behave impulsively or violently, and daydream excessively. As adolescents, they are more likely to take drugs and engage in risky behaviors. As adults, they are more likely to be violent toward themselves and others. Instead of meeting their needs and the needs of their families, society punishes and medicates these youngsters to make them behave. Capitalism deprives the majority of what they produce. Deprived adults cannot provide what children need to thrive. Deprived children grow up believing they don't deserve to have their needs met. Employers capitalize on low self-esteem to take even more from workers, creating more deprived adults, more deprived children, and an expanding ocean of misery. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Family violence. It would be hard to find a group or institution in American society in which violence is more of an everyday occurrence than it is within the family. People long for their families to be a refuge, the heart of a heartless world. Sadly, families are anything but safe. One is much more likely to be assaulted or murdered by a family member than by a stranger. More than 1 in 3 Americans has witnessed an incident of domestic violence, and 80% of children experience violence from their siblings. Almost 1 in 3 adults has experienced physical assault, sexual assault, or a combination of both during childhood. While family violence occurs in all social classes, it occurs more frequently as one moves down the social ladder. More stress and fewer options increase the likelihood of interpersonal violence. An overwhelmed parent who can find no relief is more likely to explode in frustration than one who can hire a babysitter and get a few hours off. Families with annual incomes under $15,000 suffer 6 times more physical and sexual child abuse. This figure may be inflated. Poor families are scrutinized more by authorities, while better-off families can hide their problems more easily. However, severe physical abuse is difficult to hide. One study found that parents who worked in semi-skilled or unskilled jobs were 3 times more likely than professional parents to seriously physically harm their children. People commonly dismiss the link between deprivation and violence with comments like, "Not everyone who comes from poverty is violent, so it must be that some people choose to behave badly." This is a curious reaction. Everyone accepts that the cold virus causes colds, even though not everyone who is exposed to a cold virus gets a cold. Likewise, not everyone who suffers from poverty becomes violent. Nevertheless, in both cases, the probability of being afflicted increases with exposure. One could argue that poverty creates violence in the same way that germs cause disease. The probability that any particular individual will be violent and the probability that any particular individual will get sick depends on past and present conditions. The developing nervous system is very sensitive to stress. Stable conditions in childhood increase resilience to stress, whereas chaotic conditions increase vulnerability to stress. Family background is one reason why some people remain cool under severe stress, while others lose it in response to seemingly mild stress. Strong social bonds increase resilience to stress. Families and individuals who band together for mutual support are more stable and less violent than families and individuals who lack social support. Children who suffered bad treatment, yet grew up to become kind and generous adults, had at least one person along the way, a relative, teacher, neighbor, who treated them well. Adults who were badly parented themselves can become good parents when they are provided with social support. One study found that regular home visits from a nurse beginning in pregnancy and continuing through a child's second birthday significantly reduced child abuse among highly disadvantaged families, and the effects were long-lasting. Those who dismiss social conditions and insist that people always have a choice are unrealistic and lack compassion. It's easy to condemn the behaviors of others from a safe distance. As Chapter 4 explained, severe stress causes the brain to react automatically with flight, fight, and freeze reactions, providing no time for conscious choice. Like Andrea Yates, people who feel overwhelmed do not make good choices. People make better choices when they have more support. Blaming individuals for family problems undercuts efforts to improve social conditions and provide people with more choices. The state sanctions family violence by permitting adults to use force against children for discipline and control. In the United States, 1/4 of all children between 1 month and 6 months of age are hit, and half of all children between 6 months and 1 year of age are hit. As long as reasonable force is applied, parents cannot be prosecuted for physically assaulting their children. Most people think that spanking children is harmless. However, children do not think like adults. In most cases, the harm does not lie in the severity of the violence, but in its emotional impact. When a child is completely dependent upon someone who becomes a source of pain and humiliation, that child feels confused and frightened. Long-lasting emotional problems can result. Nearly 100 studies have documented a link between childhood spanking and adult mental health problems. One study found that almost 80% of people had been slapped, spanked, or both by an adult during childhood. 40% of the people in this study reported being frequently slapped or spanked as children. This group suffered much higher rates of anxiety and were more likely to have drug or alcohol problems as adults. Keep in mind the strong connection between family deprivation and family violence. The harmful effects of spanking cannot be separated from the impact of living in overly stressed families. Societies that foster equality and cooperation suffer less interpersonal violence. In a world where the strong dominate the weak and where diplomacy is backed by force, using violence against children is not surprising. Even though family members have a common interest in cooperating, parents are encouraged to view youngsters as unmanageable and in need of a firm hand. The possibility that children might want to cooperate and could be encouraged to cooperate is dismissed as a nice idea that could never work in practice. In fact, punishment is what doesn't work. Actions speak louder than words. Physical punishment demonstrates to children that those with more power have the right to use violence against those with less power. Like children, hamsters also learn by example. Studies show that when normally placid hamsters are threatened and attacked as youngsters, they grow up to be cowards when caged with larger hamsters and bullies when caged with smaller ones. Battle of the sexes? When people hear the phrase domestic violence or spouse abuse, they usually picture a man hitting a woman. There are many reasons for this. The women's movement of the 1970s brought the issue of violence against women to public attention and secured funding for a network of shelters for battered women. Feminism promotes the view that men seek power over women and children because it is in their nature to do so. The assumption that males are naturally more violent than females has caused most research on domestic violence to examine male perpetrators and female victims. In contrast, violence perpetrated by women against men is not considered to be a social problem. Female perpetrated violence is underestimated for several reasons. Female victims are more likely to report spousal violence than males, who are ashamed to admit they were assaulted by females. Most studies do not distinguish between minor assaults perpetrated by both men and women and serious assaults that are more commonly perpetrated by men. These factors combine to give the mistaken impression that domestic violence is always serious, if not life-threatening, and that women only attack men in self-defense. The private nature of relationships makes it difficult to know for certain how much men and women contribute to violent encounters. The problem cannot be attributed solely to a battle between the sexes, because same-sex relationships are also afflicted with interpersonal violence. Studies show that men in relationships with men are battered as often as women in relationships with men, and between 17 and 45% of lesbians report having been the victim of at least one act of physical violence perpetrated by a female partner. A fuller awareness of the ways that men and women hurt each other would be useful. However, many feminists oppose research on female-perpetrated violence for fear that evidence of battered husbands will undermine efforts to combat wife abuse. They have reason to fear. Anti-feminists have opposed funding for domestic violence programs that refuse to acknowledge females as perpetrators. I have treated battered women, abused men, and adults of both sexes who were maltreated in childhood by mothers, fathers, brothers, and sisters. It does not help to debate whether men or women are more responsible for domestic violence. All victims of family violence deserve support, and all perpetrators need treatment. Making men tough. To understand why men are violent, we only need to look at how they are socialized. Society directs an astonishing level of violence against males. Teaching males to be tough prepares them for a world of compete or die, where death is preferable to failure. The most sensitive parts of men's bodies are singled out for attack. Parents are encouraged to circumcise their sons in the first week of life, a traumatic procedure that is commonly performed without anesthetic. The same surgery done on female infants, removing the skin around the clitoris, is illegal and deplored as cruel and mutilating. More than 13% of boys have experienced assaults directed at their genitals, and 10% of boys have been kicked in the groin before junior high school. While boys are subjected to physical violence, they are prohibited from expressing pain or vulnerability. In films, a man being kicked in the groin is usually presented as comical, despite the excruciating pain of such trauma. Laughing at someone's pain is a sign of dissociation, and both girls and boys are taught to deny male vulnerability from an early age. Sexist stereotypes depict real men as strong and powerful, not as victims. To be a victim is to be without power, like a woman. And the most important thing for a man is to not be a woman. Males victimized by females are especially shamed and ridiculed. One of my students confessed that she found herself laughing while reading a description of a woman battering her husband until she realized she would be screaming bloody murder if the roles were reversed. Taunts like, "Don't be a crybaby," "Don't be a girl," teach boys to feel ashamed of feeling scared or hurt. The belief that even very young boys should be tough causes them to be separated from their mothers much earlier than girls. Males are discouraged from showing feelings other than anger, which is considered a manly emotion because of its power. Consequently, boys learn to respond with anger, even rage, when they feel vulnerable or detect vulnerability in other males. Homophobic bullying is a common way for boys and men to bolster their masculine identity. The school system plays an important role in promoting violence against young males. Physical abuse during initiation rituals for social clubs and sports teams is justified as character building. In Columbine High School, site of the 1999 shooting massacre, sports initiation rituals included senior wrestlers twisting the nipples of newcomers until they turned purple, and older tennis players sending hard volleys into the backsides of younger ones. School transforms recreational play into war games, where there is no gain without pain, preferably the other guy's pain. Sports train young men to hurt others and to risk being hurt in order to win. Head injuries and concussions are common in ice hockey, so an injury prevention video was developed for players aged 9 to 10. However, 22 of 34 minor league coaches refused to show the teams the video because they thought it would decrease aggressive play, make players think they will hurt other players on the ice, and decrease competitive success in the game, close quote. The pressure for men to appear invincible can be lethal. In the summer of 2001, 6 players died from heat stroke during football practice. One of them was Minnesota Vikings Pro Bowl tackle Corey Stringer. On the day of Stringer's collapse, the heat index peaked at 103 degrees, yet he remained at practice even after vomiting several times, one of the most well-known signs of severe heat-related problems. Despite the publicity surrounding Stringer's death 2 days later, Northwestern's Rashidi Wheeler collapsed and died after an intense practice in stifling heat. The pressure not to wimp out is so strong that Wheeler spent his last conscious moments protesting his removal from the field. Shame and rage. Shame plays an important role in interpersonal violence. Shame is the intensely painful feeling of being unworthy or unacceptable, a loser. Intolerable shame can transform into anger or rage that is directed at oneself or at someone else. Rage and shame reinforce each other in a downward spiral that can erupt into violence. The most common source of shame is the social hierarchy that divides people into a few winners and many more losers. The lower down the ladder you stand, the harder it is to feel good about yourself. Studies show that those most likely to injure their partners are not the most powerful people, but the most powerless. Abusive men are more likely to feel like failures, to be unemployed or intermittently employed, and to have less than high school education. They are also more likely to suffer from addictions that temporarily soothe their inner anguish, but also increase their shame and consequent rage. Mothers are usually blamed when their sons have relationship problems. However, researchers have found that fathers play a more important role. In The Abusive Personality, Violence and Control in Intimate Relationships, Donald Dutton notes, quote, "To our surprise, we found that the biggest childhood contributors to adult male abusiveness were, in order of importance, feeling rejected by one's father, feeling a lack of warmth from one's father, being physically abused by one's father, being verbally abused by one's father, and feeling rejected by one's mother. It seemed that the emotional aspect of paternal treatment was paramount. Being punished in a rejecting way by your father was the worst thing that could happen, far worse than simply being punished," close quote. The human longing for connection is incompatible with the competition that capitalism demands. Intimacy requires openness and vulnerability, while competition favors secrecy and guardedness. Fathers consider it their duty to toughen their sons to help them succeed in life. A conflict is created between the son who needs his father's affection and the father who has learned to suppress his own emotions and thinks his son should do the same. The child who is ridiculed by the parent for feeling needy is put in an impossible position. Shame at displeasing the parent increases the need for reassurance, and the shame of needing reassurance. Both girls and boys learn to avoid this problem by never stating what they want and then punishing those who fail to deliver. Both girls and boys learn to avoid this problem by never stating what they want and then punishing those who fail to deliver. This behavior pattern commonly precedes interpersonal violence. On the surface, wife battering looks like a display of male power. In reality, most men who batter or kill their female partners feel extremely dependent and extremely ashamed of their dependence. The desire for complete control over the partner is in direct proportion to the sense of unworthiness and fear of loss. As the longing for love competes with the fear of rejection, frustration is directed at those who fail, as fail they must to take away the pain. A battering cycle can begin where discontent builds into an explosion of rage that drives the partner away. Terror at the prospect of being abandoned leads to acts of contrition to draw the partner back. The return of the partner revives the fear of being shamed through rejection, and anger builds again. These people are at their partner's throats one minute and at their knees the next. Men are most likely to murder their partners when they feel least powerful, when the partner leaves or threatens to leave. Those who kill their partners often kill themselves at the same time. In general, men are 11 times more likely than women to kill themselves when a relationship breaks up. Such violence is not a result of male power, but the tragic outcome of traumatizing males and then shaming them for feeling hurt and needing comfort. As early as 5 years of age, males are more likely than females to kill themselves. This difference increases through life. By age 22, men are 6 times more likely, and by age 85, 15 times more likely to kill themselves. Shared stress and mutual violence. Interpersonal violence is a defense against feeling powerless, and both boys and girls learn this in the family. Sons of violent parents are 1,000 times more likely to beat their female partners than sons of non-violent parents. Daughters of violent parents are 600 times more likely to assault their male partners than daughters of non-violent parents. Women suffer more serious violence from male partners than men suffer from female partners. This is an undeniable social problem. At the same time, most violence in intimate relationships is minor and mutual. Within this more common category, women are as likely to incite the violence as their male partners. The 2003 Youth Risk Behavior Survey found that 8.9% of boys and 8.8% of girls in high school reported being hit, slapped, or physically hurt on purpose by a girlfriend or boyfriend. Examples of adult mutual violence are routinely found in police reports. Here are a couple of items from my local newspaper. Domestic dispute. Husband and wife arrested after they started punching each other during an argument. Both are charged with assault. Couple charged in domestic. A husband, 46, and wife, 45, were both charged with assault after an argument turned physical. Both suffered minor injuries but did not require medical attention. These are not descriptions of male dominance and female submission. This is mutual aggression that results when overly stressed individuals take their frustrations out on each other. In such disputes, women are generally disadvantaged in size and strength. At the same time, many men refuse to fight back in the belief that only cowards hit women. When it comes to children, women are more violent than men. One study found that mothers were the assailants in 52% of child abuse cases. In another study, mothers were the perpetrators 61% of the time. Women who were themselves being battered were more likely to hurt their own children. These findings are consistent with the premise that lack of choices and lack of power increase the likelihood of interpersonal violence. That females can be violent should not be surprising. The double burden of work and family duties falls on women, who also have more financial stress. Anger is a response to injustice, and women's oppression provides a daily diet of injustice. Depression is another response to injustice, and no one disputes that depression is common among women. However, female rage remains controversial, partially because sexist stereotypes define females as nurturing and submissive. It is easier to blame men for family violence. However, in Myths of Male Dominance, anthropologist Eleanor Burke Leacock warns, "To consign the grim brutalities of abused power we see everywhere about us to what amounts to masculine original sin not only denies the historical and ethnographic record, plus what we may personally know of individual men, but seriously disarms all of us as humanity in the urgency of our need to understand and redirect our social life if we would ensure ourselves a future." Close quote. Tainted love. People look to their family and personal relationships for understanding, acceptance, and relief from the rat race. Some find comfort, many do not. Different social expectations for men and women create barriers to intimacy. Because women are expected to be caregivers in the family, they are raised to be warm and responsive. Because men are expected to compete at work, they are trained to be aggressive and action-oriented. Incompatible gender roles are not the only barriers to closeness. Same-sex couples have just as much difficulty. After many years of pondering why so many relationships fail, I have come to the following conclusions. Mutually satisfying relationships are based on equality and cooperation. Capitalism cultivates inequality and competition. Marriage expert John Gottman discovered that when one or both partners expresses contempt for the other, rolling eyes, condescending tone of voice, the marriage is more likely to fail. Contempt is an expression of superiority and inequality. Daily frustrations and humiliations increase the need for comfort and reassurance. At the same time, work and domestic chores consume so much time and energy that too frequently emotional needs are put on hold. The combination of pressing needs and insufficient time breeds resentment and anger. When there doesn't seem to be enough to go around, people compete for what little there is. Children compete for their parents' time. Adults compete for each other's love. The winners of this competition feel anxious about losing what they have. The losers feel hurt and resentful. Everyone feels cheated. Relationships that begin full of hope break down in anguish. The competition of capitalism reproduces itself in the most private corners of our lives. When relationships don't work, people wrongly assume that the problem is a lack of love, lack of trying, or a mismatch of individuals. The material and social pressures that make it so difficult for relationships to work are seldom considered. People blame themselves, "I'm not good enough," and each other, "You don't care about me." The man who feels ashamed of having emotional needs blames his wife for not knowing how to meet them. The woman who is exhausted from her double day blames her husband for not helping more. Social pressures make it difficult for people to create satisfying relationships and leave intolerable relationships. There is a tremendous pressure to stay together, regardless of the level of suffering. Women's low pay keeps them financially dependent on men, especially when they have children. The state insists that men support women and children, regardless of their ability to do so. People who feel trapped in relationships are more likely to attack each other. The next chapter explains how even the misery created by capitalism is exploited for profit. Summary. Capitalism organizes the maintenance and reproduction of the labor force in isolated family units. Because social services are inadequate, individual women are compelled to do most of this work in the home. The current family system controls men by forcing them to support women and children and deprives children of the social support they need to thrive. Human beings seek comfort and connection in personal relationships. However, female oppression, male trauma, lack of support, and a competitive social environment make sustained emotional closeness virtually impossible. Family conflict results from too much work, too little time, too few choices, and the unreasonable expectations that love alone can solve all problems. And that concludes Chapter 7, Burdening the Family, From Power and Powerlessness, by Susan Rosenthal. We'll continue next week with Chapter 8 of the book, Power and Powerlessness, by Susan Rosenthal. In the meantime, you can obtain the entire book in various ways through the author's website at susanrosenthal.com. That's RosenThal.com. After we read the book together over the coming weeks, I'll be interviewing Dr. Rosenthal and asking her my questions and yours. If you have questions and comments about the book you'd like her to respond to during the interview, please email them to me at the email link on the Unwelcome Guests website at unwelcomeguests.org, where MP3 downloads of this and all previous episodes are also available. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome.